Welcome to the Building Stories podcast series. My name is Amy Barnes, and I'll be your host as we explore some of Ontario's built heritage. This series will include 15 podcasts in total, so if you enjoyed today's show, be sure to check out some of the others. Each podcast is going to explore a different topic related to heritage conservation in different regions of Ontario. Today's podcast will be a little different from the others, since we're not going to explore a single building, but instead, we're going to look at a local heritage project. This project is going to explore a whole bunch of buildings and the stories that relate to the people connected to them. So let's get started. The place we are heading to today saw the arrival of Europeans in 1832, was incorporated as a town in 1859, and became a city in 1886. Named after the English town, Stratford-upon-Avon, it will come as no surprise to many that we are headed to Stratford, Ontario, home of the beautiful Avon River and the famous Stratford Shakespeare Festival. Now, for anyone who has been to Stratford, it will also come as no surprise that the symbol for the city is a swan. Every year, there are 2 black swans and 24 white swans that are released into the Avon River and are enjoyed by visitors and locals alike. Although the population of Stratford is over 30,000 people today, it has humble beginnings as a railway junction. It is with the arrival of the Grand Trunk Railway and the Buffalo Lake Huron Line in 1856 that really solidified Stratford's history as a major rail center. The Canadian National Railway was a major economic influence right up until it closed shop in 1964. Along with the railway, the other major economic driver was the furniture industry. Now, as was the times in the early 1900s, there were many industrial disputes and strikes going on from the workers. One in particular in 1933 was started by the furniture workers, which got so out of hand that the army was called in to help. Now, this famous strike would mark the last time the army would be called in to help with any strike in Canadian history. The story of this strike was also made into a play called King Whistle by James Reaney. Now, as both the railway and furniture industry began to wane, a Stratford-born reporter named Tom Patterson and a group of local enthusiasts opened the Stratford Festival. Since its conception in 1953, the festival continues to grow and attract world-class performances. It has also since become a key piece of Stratford's economy, as thousands of people go to Stratford every year to see the plays and take in the many art festivals. But Stratford isn't just talented in the acting department. It also has the distinction of being one of 7 municipalities on this planet that is recognized as the smartest city by the Intelligence Community Forum in 2011. Now, this was a huge jump up from 21st to 7th from the year before, but both are worth bragging about. So look out, visitors. They're not just putting on an act there. They have the brains to back it. With this in mind, it is not surprising that the Stratford-Perth County branch of the ACO had the genius idea to start a local heritage initiative, which has really just taken off in the community. It is called the Historical Plaquing Program, and although it seems very simple in concept, there is a lot of hard work done by volunteers which go on behind the scenes before any property gets a plaque. I had a phone conversation with Ted Hales, who is president of the branch, about how the program got started, and here's what he had to say.
In June of 2011, at our annual meeting, branch annual meeting, we had a presentation from one of our members about the possibility of a plaque program. And at that time, unanimously, everyone in the branch decided let's go for it. They voted to go ahead. We struck a planning committee, and from June into the fall, the planning committee met, looked at all the parameters of the program, as well as the practical stuff, what the sign would look like, what material the plaque would be made of, the protocol, what would be on the plaque, and all that was worked out, so that by the time we reached the fall in October, we were ready to go ahead. And I offered my home as the first property to be plaqued, and we proceeded from there.
The plaques contain 3 simple but important pieces of information: the date of construction, the name, and the occupation of the first resident. Now, the decision was made to put the name of the first resident as opposed to the builder or architect because, much like architects today, they might have built for 4 or 5 homes, having never lived in any of them, but instead renting them out or selling them right away. So by putting the first resident who lived there and the occupation of that resident, the plaque meets the overall goal of the program, which is to demonstrate the social history of the community. It's the people, not the architectural details of the building that are on display and that are commemorated. The plaques are made by local artist Philip Yielding. Philip worked with the committee to help decide the color and the materials the plaques would be because they wanted one that would be aesthetically pleasing regardless if the house was made of yellow brick, red brick, plaster, or so on. Ted also makes it clear to all that are interested that they are not selling plaques, but rather they're offering people the opportunity to participate in the plaque program. There's a formal application that must be submitted, and there is a total cost of $125. The fee primarily covers the construction cost of the plaque, and the research is done by a dedicated group of hardworking volunteers. The program is only open to those properties that were built before the Second World War, mostly because the records for those are now part of the public domain. Anything after that, they might be dealing with copyright restrictions on them, and the information is a lot harder to find. As of the time of this recording in the fall of 2013, there were 89 plaques that were participating in the program. ACO committee members do all the research for each plaque, and Ted himself has spent many hours at the archives, combing local cemetery lists, working on Ancestry.ca, and numerous other historical materials in order to find the stories behind the people. He says sometimes it's easy, sometimes it's hard, and sometimes, as Ted recounts, you get so engrossed of the lives of the people you've never met that you don't know where to stop your research. I asked Ted to tell me about some of his experiences doing research, and here's what he had to say.
Well, you get attached. If you're doing the research, you get attached to the individual. And certainly in the 1800s, you discover that a couple that were married, they might have five children, of which only one survived past the age of 12 or 13. So you get a real feel for their lives, and you discover how different careers they've had. One of the things we've discovered is there's a number of properties where it was the individual was a woman, and of course they weren't working, so it's a gentlewoman that is on their plaque, and that means that she was of independent means. And a couple of those are people that have lost their spouse, and our researchers say that they're amazed at how resilient women are. And doing the research, you discover that in their marriage, they might have had 12 pregnancies. They've lost two or three children, and they've lived into their 80s and some into their 90s, where a lot of the men died much, much younger. So the women are very strong. That's one of the things we've realized, and that's a very interesting fact. One property that I researched is a house on Ontario Street. And as an example there, I discovered after about 60 hours of research through Ancestry.ca, I got very attached to her. Her name was Daisy Macklin, and she became one of Ontario's first women doctors. She went to medical school just after women were allowed to go to medical school. And her family, her father and his first wife, Daisy's mom, had eight children. Daisy's mom died when she was 3 years old. Her father remarried 3-4 years later and had another seven children. So of this family of 15 children, four became doctors. Her father had been a dry goods merchant, discovered that in County Tyrone in Ireland, they had a fair bit of financial background, so they came to Canada with some money. They then sent, in addition to Daisy, three of their sons to medical school. Four became doctors. One of Daisy's brothers went with his wife, who was a doctor from Detroit, and they went to school together at U of T. They went to Nanking in China and founded a medical mission in late 1880s. They were there 40 years, and the medical mission itself is still there. It's been restored a few years ago, and it's part of a major health facility in Nanjing. And so it's just amazing. And Daisy, when she graduated, she set up her practice in Stratford and then left for China, spent a few years with her brother working in the medical mission, and then came back to Stratford and built her house on Ontario Street, opened her practice, and in 1912, 25. She had to close her practice. Her health was bad, and she died shortly after that, just in her early 50s, but just an amazing woman.
For those of you in the Stratford area, Daisy's house is number 196 Ontario Street. Ted offers another story to show how interesting the research process can be.
So a lot of the research has produced people who worked for the railway, a lot of brakemen, and it was one of the most, if not the most, dangerous occupations. The brakemen had to move on top of the train from car to car, and the wheels that controlled the brakes on each car were up on the top of the car. And regardless of the weather, rain, snow, high wind, they had to go from car to car and control the brakes. And quite often, they did have lots of accidents, as well as a couple of men lost their lives.
The program is open to all types of buildings, so they can include residential, commercial, institutional, and so on. And they're not just limited to those that are designated under the Ontario Heritage Act. Ted and I both agree this is a major strength to the program. Ted told me that when a plaque goes up on the street, it often spurs on others in the neighborhood to apply for one. The record so far is an application came in within a half an hour of one being put up down the street. The program is such a simple idea, yet often it uncovers a deeper story behind the person, and therefore the history of the town. I will end this podcast with Ted explaining what keeps him motivated with the plaquing program.
I would say the most rewarding is when the plaques are presented. The best heartwarming treat is to see people's response, and everybody, the homeowners, are just taken with what they're hearing, and they get really excited. And most of them say, I've just got to go on and find more about my property. I'm so taken with it.
Well, that brings us to the end of our podcast. If you want to learn more about Daisy's house, you can check out the entry for it on the Building Stories website, which is at www.buildingstories.co. I would like to take this moment to thank Ted Hales for speaking to me about the historical plaquing program in Stratford. Congratulations on all your success. The Building Stories podcast series could not have been made possible without our sponsors, so a big thank you to the Architectural Conservancy of Ontario, the Heritage Resource Centre at the University of Waterloo, the Centre for Community Mapping, the Computer Systems Group at the University of Waterloo, and the Government of Ontario. If you have any comments, we would love to hear from you. You can email the Building Stories team at info@buildingstories.co or send them a tweet at Building Stories, which is BLDG_stories, and of course you can find them on Facebook under the Building Stories Facebook page. These podcasts have been written, produced, and hosted by myself, Amy Barnes, and I'd like to take this last moment to thank you all for listening.